Having a baby. It sounds so simple, doesn't it? But for many couples, it can be a distant dream. One in six couples in Australia and New Zealand experience problems when they're trying to conceive. Some of them turn to surrogacy, but there's a very specific legal situation for that in Australia. We have what's called altruistic surrogacy. It's meant to be a gift from the surrogate to the intended parents. But what if the woman having the pregnancy ends up financially worse off, and her own family too? Let us know if you've gone through a surrogacy experience and what cost it's had on you and your family via our Facebook page. You don't need to leave a public comment if you'd rather not. You can send us a private message on Facebook instead. Charlie Lee is with us. She's been a surrogate. She has five children of her own. She also donates eggs to couples trying to have a child. And Charlie joins us from our Brisbane studio. Welcome to Life Matters.
Hi, Hilary.
Charlie, what made you want to be a surrogate mother originally?
I think it's been in the back of my mind for a while. I remember hearing or watching a documentary back in, I think it was 96, from America, and I guess it set the seeds for that in the past. And when I had finished having my own family, I thought, well, why not? My ideal family wasn't really something that came to the forefront, but I can at least help others, you know, reach their dreams.
And when you went through the process, were you surprised by any of the impacts the surrogacy process had on you?
I think that with everything in life, you can't always foresee every circumstances, and communication is really the key to making these things work.
So emotionally, I imagine, you know, it has its ups and downs like any pregnancy. But let's look at the financial strain that the process put on you and your family. What were some of the things that cropped up for you guys?
So the biggest thing for me was that I was working as a cleaner when I had the successful pregnancy, and by about 26 weeks in the pregnancy, I was unable to, I guess, get down low enough to get some of the items done, and so my boss actually had to let me go because I was unable to fulfill my duties correctly, which left my family and myself without an income.
And so what did you do for that period of time?
I was very lucky that my intended parents were really forthcoming, and they did subsidise some of my lost wages to the degree that their legal representative had told them was correct for them to pay me.
Because there are strict rules around that, aren't there? They can't go beyond a certain level.
That's correct. So what we were told was that, or by their lawyer, was that they could pay, it was approximately 2/3 of my weekly wage up until 8 weeks postpartum.
And what about the other little bits and pieces of expenses that you found over the course of the pregnancy?
I guess my intended parents were pretty good at covering most of those costs. It was mostly just little things like petrol, which I didn't want to ask for because maybe it's a 10-minute drive because, you know, I'm in the city, when they were paying a lot more themselves because they were actually 2 hours away for our appointments. So I think little things like that do begin to add up, buying takeaway because I'm too tired to cook. All those sort of things do start to impact on, I guess, you know, your financial situation at home.
And when you set up the arrangement with the couple, did you all sit down and talk about what might happen if those kinds of events occurred, how you deal with those kinds of costs, or was losing your job just a really unexpected thing?
Yeah, well, losing my job was unexpected because when we initially started, I actually wasn't working, although they knew I was looking for work. And we had discussed that, you know, if I wasn't able to work due to sickness, et cetera, that they would, you know, obviously compensate my lost wages to the degree that they were legally allowed to. But I guess, yeah, losing my job completely was definitely something that we didn't take into consideration. And it also meant that after the pregnancy, I didn't quite meet the requirements for the paid parental leave, so that wasn't an option either.
So back to work pretty much straight away.
Well, that's the thing. It's so hard to get a job in this, you know, current economic climate, and finding a job was very, very difficult. And so I didn't actually get a job until I think the surrogate baby was nearly 6 months old, and I still had some physical issues due to the pregnancy because it was my sixth pregnancy, and I had a couple of injuries. And so unfortunately, that job didn't last very long either.
It's a really interesting area. Charlie, we're going to talk to the lawyer involved in this case, but I'm wondering if you're listening at home, let us know if you've gone through the surrogacy experience and what cost it's had on you and your family. You can go to our Facebook page and leave a message there if you'd prefer not to leave a comment. Charlie Lee has been a surrogate and plans to be a surrogate again, if possible. And we're also joined by fertility lawyer Stephen Page. He founded the LGBT Family Law Institute in Australia as well. Stephen, welcome.
G'day, Hilary.
What is the current status of surrogacy laws around Australia? Are they consistent across all the states and territories?
In theory, but not in practice. Each state and territory has laws allowing altruistic surrogacy and banning commercial surrogacy. The Northern Territory doesn't have any laws. So you would think there's a free-for-all there, but unfortunately there's not. If there's no law to transfer parentage, therefore, in effect, you can't do it there, at least through a clinic. You might have to do it at home. The good news is that the territory is looking at having laws on surrogacy. In fact, there's a forum, public forum in Darwin tomorrow and one in Alice Springs on Monday.
And how many parents do we know go through a surrogacy process each year and kind of struggle through this fragmented legal landscape?
Well, my best guess is that there would be 60 or 70 kids a year born in Australia. The problem is that the statistics from New South Wales and Victoria are unclear. The kids born there are bunched in with the adoption statistics, and it's difficult to break them apart. The number of children who are born overseas through surrogacy to Australian intended parents, from recollection, is 179 in the 2018 year. So for every child born within Australia through domestic surrogacy, there are about three currently who are born overseas through international surrogacy.
When we look at out-of-pocket expenses like the ones Charlie talked about earlier, do they vary depending on the nature of the relationship between the surrogate parent and the intended parents, or are there clear rules, legal rules, about who should pay for what?
There aren't clear legal rules, and the problem that you identified is that there are great differences in the law between the states. In Victoria, for instance, it's illegal to provide life insurance for a surrogate. So here's a woman who has, like any other pregnant woman, a 1 in 10,000 chance of dying from pregnancy or childbirth, and you can't insure her life. It's against the law to do so. Now, there are proposals in Victoria through a government review there to change that, but that's the current state of the law. Whereas if you go further north, for example, in New South Wales and Queensland, it's lawful to do so. If you have an interstate matter where the intended parents live in one state and the surrogate lives in the other, you're running this labyrinth, not only of the law, the very quite complex law at times in your own state, but also having to make sure that you don't breach it interstate.
What about the issue of income protection insurance? It's illegal to buy life insurance. Why would it be illegal to buy income protection insurance to cover people like Charlie?
Well, it is in Victoria. It's not, for example, in New South Wales and Queensland. I certainly recommend that surrogates are covered by life insurance and income protection insurance. Sometimes it's not available. For example, the surrogate has a health condition, so she may be uninsurable for life insurance. It may be that she's not working and as a result can't get income protection insurance. But wherever possible, I urge my clients to do that because surrogates are incredibly generous women. They ought to be cherished. And they're putting their life on the line to give the gift of life to someone else. So you've got to look after them.
I have to ask, Stephen, too, you're a lawyer, you do a lot of surrogacy law, and that's an unavoidable legal cost for parents wanting to go through this process. Would you like to see the laws change so that that was less of a cost impact on parents going through surrogacy?
Absolutely. Why do we have to charge more for clients to say the law in Western Australia is different to the law in Queensland and we have to redraft the agreement? What we've seen with commercial law around the country is, thankfully, in many ways, just the one law. And that saved companies a lot of money. Why can't ordinary mums and dads, as we've seen under the Family Law Act, why can't ordinary mums and dads have one set of laws and save money on lawyers? It's absolutely nuts that we have currently seven systems of law concerning surrogacy, plus some federal law. And soon we're going to have eight. And none of them actually see eye to eye. The House of Reps said back in 2016 we should have national model laws. The federal government only responded to that inquiry back late last year and said, oh, we better look at it with the states. Well, nothing's happened. It's not good enough.
Charlie, I want to ask you, when you started with considering being a surrogate and looking at the process, was it easy to understand the legal situation that you'd be putting yourself in? Was there enough information for you to draw on?
No, it was really, really hard. Most of my research would bring up stuff from America or Canada or even England, but there really wasn't anything out there. In fact, one of the first things I came across when my search was actually Stephen Page, and I actually initially made contact and we did have some discussions when I was first looking into it, and he was able to give me some direction as to where to find some of the information, which I ended up using to...
I'm looking surprised at this moment, Hillary. This is this is news to my ears.
You've got a very strong
web presence. But I just don't remember.
It was about 5 years ago.
There we go.
Well, Stephen, how should the government legislate for compensating surrogate mothers? Because do you want it approached more as an economic transaction, or do you want to somehow keep that sense of it being altruistic but make sure people are covered?
You've got to have the human spirit. You've got to have the human spirit. You can't have a surrogacy arrangement that works if you don't have that human spirit. If you treat it just as a transaction, it'll fail. It'll fail. And you'll find that you'll have intended parents who are traumatised, or you'll have surrogates and their partners who are traumatised, or all of the above. And the child in the middle of it all can really cop it bad. So we just don't want to treat it just as a transaction. We want to make sure that it's a very human experience. Surrogacy at its best is an incredibly magical experience. In terms of money, surrogates shouldn't be out of pocket. What we've seen from inquiries recently in the last year or so in Victoria, South Australia and Western Australia is consistent. And there's been two themes in those inquiries. One is, and Charlie talked about this before, intended parents don't get enough information. The House of Representatives saw that in 2016. Unfortunately, there's not enough information. You go on your phone, you Google it, and you find some website overseas, and you go, oh, great, away we go, and really don't know what the other options are. The second theme that's come across is that surrogates are short of money. So there's got to be greater clarity. There's got to be uniformity between the states. I don't care whether we have uniform state and territory laws or whether we have Commonwealth laws, but as long as they're uniform, and as long as everyone knows what the boundaries are, that they're nice and clear and easy to understand, yes, this can be paid for, no, that can't.
We're chatting with surrogacy lawyer Stephen Page and Charlie Lee, who's been a surrogate mum and plans to do so again. Stephen, you're personally involved in a surrogacy arrangement now too. What's it like going through that process personally instead of just as a lawyer?
Well, I think the funniest thing was when I asked my associate to give my husband and I advice about it. And she said, no, you're the expert. I couldn't possibly give the advice. And I said, if you don't give the advice, but particularly I, don't appear to understand the advice, it's non-compliant, we won't get an order, get on with it. I was probably more polite than that, but I suspect I wasn't. Of course, she was smiling at me at the time that I said that. It's been a challenge. Many of my clients have straightforward journeys, and the surrogate gets pregnant. She has a trouble-free pregnancy and gives birth straight away. Ours, we've had a number of travails. One of those was we had a miscarriage, and that's really upsetting and depressing. And what I say to my clients is, with surrogacy, you will end up with a baby at the end of the day. It's a certainty. It's a question of when, not if. And there are a number of conditions about when that won't happen. But I had to convince myself, of course, well, this isn't the end of the road. The doctor's right. It's a problem with the embryo. It's not a problem with our beloved surrogate. So let's get on with it. Next pregnancy, we had an ectopic pregnancy with urgent surgery. And a surrogate said, oh, look, you know, I've let you down again. And my thinking, as I said to her, is if we get a baby or not, that's really secondary. I don't want anything bad to happen to you. I just couldn't live with myself if that happened. This time round, so we are now number three, we're going to have a baby daughter in July. and life is grand.
That's congratulations to you, Stephen. But I'm wondering if you can have a legal system that could deal with the trauma on the surrogate parent of a miscarriage or of life-saving surgery of that kind.
Oh, I think so. And, you know, a surrogate has to make a call at that stage whether she wants to proceed further or not. If she doesn't want to proceed further, well, it's her choice. She should have bodily autonomy. She shouldn't be coerced in any way. This has got to be informed consent. And if you have a miscarriage or an ectopic pregnancy, and whether you proceed or not, there should always be the option of counselling. It should always be available. There are expert fertility counsellors in this country. They do their job very well. We should be very proud of them. The IVF clinics in this country are very good. We should be very proud of them too. And if we have that counselling available, then the chance of something going wrong on a permanent basis in terms of the psychological health of the surrogate, much lower.
Now, Charlie, Stephen mentioned before that surrogacy can be a magical experience. Tell us about the relationship that you have with the child that you bore for your intended parents. And, of course, we can't identify the child or the parents here.
Look, I actually have a relationship with the parents more than I do the baby. She is absolutely a wonderful toddler, and I do catch up with them quite regularly. But yes, the relationship that the baby has with the parents is absolutely amazing, and I love watching that. But I don't personally see myself as anything more than somebody to answer questions to this child when she grows up and asks and wants to know these things, because I think that's important that this child can have those questions answered so that they're secure in their identity and their place in the world as they, you know, go through their teenage years.
Do you think it will be a bit more complicated for them working out that identity, given that, you know, they've come from different people as well?
I think if we weren't all there and so open, then yes, that could certainly have an impact on the child. But given that we all have a great relationship and that we're all very open about it, I think it'll be second nature to the child as they grow up. I've heard studies that show that this is the case in egg donation as well. And I have the same role with the egg donor children. As they grow, they can come to me and answer any questions. But again, my relationship is not with the children that are born. Just that I obviously want them to be cared for and loved and, you know, and safe. It's with the parents that I've offered to help. That's, you know, I guess where my relationship lies.
Well, I really appreciate that both of you have given your time to come and tell us a bit more about this situation on Life Matters today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Hilary.
Fertility lawyer Stephen Page, also the founder of the LGBT Family Law Institute in Australia, and Charlie Lee, who's been a surrogate and is going through that process again. And if you have a story about fertility that you'd like to share, ABC News is investigating the assisted reproductive technology industry in its new series, Making Babies. You can get involved by visiting abc.net.au/makingbabies for more information, and that includes surrogacy and IVF.